KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
On To the Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Donald Trump is probably the most significant thing to happen to the religious right in a few decades.
OMG, this guy is actually a bigot.
If she becomes president, no one since Richard Nixon would have been on the national stage that long and won the White House.
I'm Warren Olney. To the Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To the Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
Something really genuinely that I was not fully prepared for. And you can say, oh, you've been in the business, you know, 3 decades, you've done all this blah, blah, blah. But nothing prepares you for directing except directing.
James Shamus, fired in 2013 as head of Focus Features, decided to make some bold choices. Not only would he direct, but his first project would be a somber 1950s drama based on the Philip Roth novel, Indignation. As a former producer and longtime studio executive, Shamus knew the odds weren't exactly in his favor. He explains what motivated him and tells us why he doesn't believe in asking for advice. But first, on the Hollywood News Banter, Netflix promises to spend even bigger. Stay tuned, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my fellow banterer who is in New York at this moment, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi, Kim.
So the television critics are gathered in Beverly Hills for the long series of presentations from various networks. And this, of course, you know, they're trying to tell you what shows they have coming up and sell the critics who are gathered there that these are great shows. However, the critics can be a pretty tough audience. Now, the first one out of the box, I think, was Netflix, which is a change in and of itself, you know, Netflix presenting these things. And Ted Sarandos, who's the head creative guy at Netflix, probably terrified everybody else in the television business by saying that the $6 billion that Netflix has been spending on programming, that is not the ceiling. It will go up, he said.
Yeah, I mean, you hear that as a rival of Netflix and your knees start to buckle, because that's the problem in TV right now, is everyone is competing for these top shows to try to break out of the clutter of this peak TV moment where there's hundreds and hundreds of shows. And if Netflix is willing to spend $100 million on a show and greenlight $6-7 billion worth of content, how do you compete with that?
Yeah, and Sarandos, meanwhile, said we're not responsible for peak TV at Netflix, although, boy, they sure have a lot of programming. You know, he added insult to injury. There are too many mediocre shows on television, but we have been able, I'm paraphrasing a bit, to give the fans what they want. So he's basically saying everybody else is not giving fans what they want, and therefore the glut is not his fault. Now, meanwhile, of course, they announced a bunch of renewals for existing shows, and some of those, you know, they don't reveal numbers. They don't reveal ratings. Everybody's trying to guess. It's a source of great frustration to their competitors. They're renewing shows. We don't know how many people are watching. And as Sarandos says, that is not their model. But they're renewing shows that it seems like nobody cares about, and in some cases that I've barely heard of.
Yeah, I mean, they just renewed Will Arnett's dramedy Flaked, which not only didn't make much buzz in terms of fans, but it kind of got wrecked by the critics as well. So it's not really a prestige play. That was somewhat of a mystery. And they've also, you know, they've committed to multiple seasons of these shows that maybe they do well on the service. Don't know. This Chelsea Handler talk show that nobody talks about also got renewed. So no one knows if Netflix has this secret formula where they're getting people to watch these shows, or if they're just renewing stuff to renew it to have content so everybody thinks that they've got all the hot shows.
It's a very expensive game. And of course, their competitors are hoping and desperately that they're going to spend themselves into oblivion.
The thing with Netflix is that, you know, all that matters to them is that the subscriber numbers continue to go up. That's what's fueling this entire bubble of content. But what we've seen in the previous quarter is that they missed their subscriber target goal. And it doesn't mean they're not growing. They're still growing, but they're not growing at the rate that they wanted to or that analysts expected them to in the previous quarter. year. So the question is, if the spending is going to go up, 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 and the subscriber numbers are going to slow, then at what point do those two meet and the financial proposition doesn't make as much sense as you might think?
As we said, the competitors are waiting and hoping. You know, and meanwhile, it's kind of a weird phenomenon that we're dealing with, which is that the competitors who are reliant on ratings are nonetheless, they seemingly in many cases, obsessed with shows that get noise but not ratings. And this goes back, you know, with AMC and Mad Men, noisy as heck in the culture, but no ratings. Now, that may help with advertisers, you know, that want a certain demographic. But the big broadcast networks love to point out, even the ones that are supposedly successful on cable in many cases, you have much smaller audiences than shows on the big broadcast networks.
Right. There's two great examples of that phenomenon right now. There's a show called Mr. Robot on the USA Network, which was previously known as having these big populist blue sky dramas that got a lot of viewers but didn't get much critical attention. And then there is Lifetime, which was never considered a critical hub, but has a show called Unreal, which got great attention from critics and a couple of Emmy nominations. And Unreal, the first season was sort of low rated. Then it got all this critical attention and some buzz. It comes back for the second season to lower ratings than the first season. But if you look at both of those shows, they are considered gigantic wins by their networks. And it's not necessarily, certainly not because they're ratings bonanzas, because they're not. It's because they are succeeding in branding those networks as places for quality. And these days, the brand associated with the network seems to be more valuable to these network owners than the actual ratings.
Meanwhile, Matt, as you are in New York and actually in a car.
In an Uber.
No free advertising. I'm going to talk about the attempt of CBS to further exploit one of its properties. And across, you know, this is a thing that networks need to try to do now. They are selling a show called Carpool Karaoke, obviously based on the success of The Late Late Show with James Corden in these amazing karaoke segments he's been doing. He won't be in this, but they are going to do a Carpool Karaoke show that has been sold to Apple Music the same day, suggesting that there is maybe a slight poverty of ideas problem. Spike TV announced something called Karaoke, get it, Showdown, Karaoke Showdown. Such an original idea, Matt.
Yeah, there's a couple things that are interesting about this. First of all, that the fact that Apple Music, which has maintained that they are not in the television business and are not interested in TV, yet again dipping their toe into TV by buying a show from CBS, perhaps the most traditional TV network out there. They have this Dr. Dre show that Apple's doing. They have an unscripted show with Ben Silverman, the producer. And here is another effort by Apple Music to sort of dip its toe before it goes full speed into TV with this Carpool Karaoke show. The second thing that's interesting in this is how much of basically a middle finger this was to the Spike Network, which the same day announced its own ripoff version. And let's be honest, it is a complete ripoff of this idea. And now you're going to have, you know, in a true, you know, modern TV showdown, you're going to have Spike TV competing with Apple Music's version of the Carpool show produced by CBS, which is a traditional TV network. So we'll see which version of this ends up being the one that viewers gravitate towards.
If either.
If either. They're both competing with the original, which is the James Corden version, which is what people actually like.
Yes, which is all over the internet. So yes, they're going to cannibalize each other. We'll watch that happen. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, executive editor of The Hollywood Reporter. James Schamus has long been a huge figure in the world of independent film. In the early 1990s, he and Ted Hope founded the production company Good Machine, which launched the careers of Ang Lee and Todd Haynes. After Universal bought the company, Schamus set off on a 13-year run as CEO of that studio's arthouse label, Focus Features. There, Schamus oversaw the production and release of such films as Lost in Translation, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, and Brokeback Mountain. But in 2013, Universal fired him and for a time decided to transform Focus into a genre label. So rather than sit in his pajamas, as he puts it, Schamus decided in his mid-50s to try something new, directing a full-length feature film. and he didn't pick easy material. Indignation is based on a Philip Roth novel set in 1951 as the Korean War rages. The film's protagonist is Marcus Messner, a brilliant Jewish boy from New Jersey who wins a scholarship to a small Christian college in Ohio. Not only does this allow Marcus to escape a life working in his father's butcher shop, it also enables him to avoid the draft. Before he leaves home, Marcus, played by Logan Lerman, has a confrontation with his anxious father, played by Danny Burstein.
There you are.
Yeah, strange. Here I am. In my own house.
I have been everywhere looking for you.
Why? 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 Somebody, tell me why.
Because if anything were to happen to you...
Oh, come
on. If anything were to ever happen to you...
What is this all about?
It's about life, Marky. It's about the tiniest mistake that can have consequences.
Oh, Christ, you sound like a fortune cookie.
You obviously left Focus. When was it?
About 2.5 years ago.
2.5 years
ago.
More
than that.
You said, I didn't want to be that guy sitting in front of the computer trying to sell people things, so I thought I'd try something else. So this is what you tried. Got well received at Sundance. We're going to talk about that. How did you finance it and put it together?
You know, the great thing about being an ex-studio chief, going to market with a very, shall we say, specialized, that is to say, profoundly depressing, but yet in its depression, I want to tell your viewers, uplifting.
Uplifting, not a clear commercial play.
Not a clear commercial play. And that was part of the logic as well as the passion that brought me to Indignation was the fact that I thought if I could grind myself into whatever nub of a filmmaker you needed to get ground into to make a film that I could make with full freedom and integrity, it was worth it. So there was no easy way in to finance the film, and we did it the old-fashioned way, which is at the end of the day, the financing came together while we were in pre-production. We probably have 18 different entities on our final circular agreement.
So you were in pre-production, so you're just confident. I don't know what kind of a budget you were gunning for.
Well, I was gunning for a budget that was certainly not the budget I ended up with.
Okay.
But we ended up with a budget that was a small single figure after the tax rebates in New York, which was a great gift to us.
I mean, it's a hell of a thing at this stage to say I'm going to direct a movie. I mean, most people who leave studio jobs produce.
Correct. And look, there's this meme out there about how difficult Philip Roth is to adapt. The track record apparently is not that good, although
there
I don't pass
Goodbye,
judgment.
Columbus.
Yeah, and I love that film. Thank you. But the track record for former executives or producers in late middle age, as I am, making movies is probably even worse. So that was part of the fun of it, to be honest. I did sit down with my family and I said, look, I know it might have been a little embarrassing having Dad get fired from his studio gig, but honestly, that's just normal for Hollywood. And I'd had a great run.
You did.
13 years at Focus Features. We made money every year. And I always say it, the last year and a half, we didn't make that much money. So we were vulnerable. That's life. But guess what? I'm probably going to be really embarrassed sometime in the next 2 years when my movie comes out because the odds are not good for me. But that's the luxury of having a certain age and trying something new. You honestly don't care that much.
You're, really?
You feel, at least I did.
I don't know if I'm there yet, but go on.
No. It was such a privilege to be at that point in my life and actually have a new challenge, something really genuinely that I was not fully prepared for. And you can say, oh, you've been in the business three decades, you've done all this blah, blah, blah. But nothing prepares you for directing except directing.
Well, so you picked this novel? Was there a script? Where walk me through how it happened.
No, I came across Philip Roth's novel actually at an airport. Believe it or not, it was a mass market paperback, which is weird once you actually read it, thinking somebody had that thought.
Right. It's based on his own life, his early experiences.
Yeah, and all of Philip Roth's work is in some measure based on his life. That's part of the game that you play when you pick up a Philip Roth novel. Is it Philip Roth? Is it this crazy persona? Is it this narrator or character? Whoever it is. But I did. I fell in love with these characters. And it was a short novel. It's one of his last novels. I think he was writing it knowing he was going to retire and quit writing. It's got a bit of an elegiac edge to it that's different from a lot of his work. And I think he's going back to a moment in his own youth. And there's an aura of empathy and of, yeah, maybe even a little bit regret in terms of the way in which this main character interacts, in particular with the young woman with whom he falls in love, who's played in the film by Sarah Gadon, who's an incredible actor. And I was very touched by that when I read the book, that Roth is really sketching out a character who is, in fact, in many ways clueless as to what this young woman's life is, what she's gone through, her traumas, the oppressions that she's facing. And he's in, you know, late age at this point and reflecting on who he was and who he wasn't. And that got me.
So you say, I'm going to do this. And how do you go about doing it?
First, you get the rights. I got the rights when I was still the CEO at Focus. I was my interest in it then was to, as I'd always done over the years there, continue writing screenplays and sometimes producing for Ang Lee.
You have written things that were not credited.
Yeah, that's the standard thing in Hollywood. You know, they go to arbitration, blah, blah, blah. But I was well compensated, so that works too.
As you're an executive, you're writing. It's just the unusual thing.
I am. But the things I was writing ended up getting made with Ang. So I was working on movies like Lust, Caution and Taking Woodstock and producing Brokeback Mountain and things like that. So I had a very healthy creative life up until the last couple years at Focus. The corporate side of the job became a little bit more, shall we say, prominent?
Yeah.
As these things do.
As the industry became more corporate. And
Yeah, I think so. And by the way, I love the job. And I even like the corporate stuff, to be honest. I mean, it is what it is. You got to get up in the morning, go to work, and you're in the movie business. Stop complaining. But it is true, I slowed down on the writing. And originally, I was going to write the screenplay for Ang Lee. He went off to do Life of Pi and got a taste of that really the extensive canvas that's available at the bigger budgets for the kinds of technologies he's interested in working on. And when I left Focus, or I should say when I was fired from Focus, I had that free time to revisit the script, revise it. And at that point, Ang was not available. And my youngest daughter was going off to college. And I was that unemployed guy actually sitting in his pajamas at noon at the computer pretending I'm at work. I thought, let's give this a shot.
And then the money part.
The money part. Here's how these things work. And it's very typical. I connected with a great independent producer named Antti Bregman, who actually got his start with me back in the day when I was co-running Good Machine with Ted Hope, who's now at Amazon Studios. And together we patched together equity from Brazil, bank facility in Canada, and a bridge loan from Canada, equity from the States, equity from China.
Individuals or companies.
Well, companies, yeah, mm-hmm. Investors. Pre-sales, territorial pre-sales in Germany. We connected to the guy I think is now the best independent film sales agent in the business, Glenn Basner at Film Nation. He went and pre-sold a bunch of the smaller territories and some bigger ones like Scandinavia. We got a bank facility to cover the advances on those.
Did you have your cast in place at that point?
You know, Logan Lerman came on very early. He was with us before we had the money together. And even Anthony and myself, we were kind of throwing some cash in just to keep afloat before pre-production officially started. And but everybody makes independent movies this way, honestly, unless you have a rich uncle who writes a check.
Right. It's interesting that you I guess you had a level of confidence that you'd get there somehow or another to just keep working and moving forward.
And again, every film you see at Sundance, I'd say 80% of them can tell you more or less the same story.
So you said previously you didn't quite have the budget that you had hoped. I'm curious what you had to give up because of that.
You know, what that forces you to do is to cut some corners. But if you cut too many corners, you're not making your movie. So the other thing you do is you change what it means to cut a corner into what it means to adapt and create anew. So yeah, in the screenplay, if you were to read a screenplay, the opening frame of the film, which takes place partially during the Korean War, so it's in Korea, and it's a big battle. So I thought, we'll just like hit them over the head with this gigantic battle. what you see in the film is a very intimate, almost I'd say personal, a series of very violent but quiet encounters with very few people. And that was simply because at a certain moment I realized that I was going to put so much money into those few seconds of film and I needed that money to tell the rest of the story. We only had 24 shooting days. It was tough, tough shoot. But it was a fun and loving shoot. And we gave up things like trailers. So, you know, Logan Lerman, who's this amazing actor and he's in almost every scene of the film, he had no place to go between – scenes. He was just hanging out with us. And it was lovely because of the kind of person he is, it worked. If he was a different kind of human being, it would have been tough.
You can't do the diva thing when you're doing an indie like that.
Mm-mm.
Coming up after a short break, James Seamus tells us why he did not seek the advice of his director friends when he set out to make his first film. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcast you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to James Seamus, writer and director of the new drama Indignation. Set in 1951, the film stars Logan Lerman as college freshman Marcus Mesner, a gifted and earnest Jewish boy from New Jersey who tries to navigate life at a Christian college in Ohio. After working up the courage to take his beautiful classmate Olivia, played by Sarah Gadden, out to dinner, he soon realizes he's out of his element.
Escargot, it's the name of the restaurant. Snails. I have a feeling Marcus Mesner has never seen them served or eaten before. You want to try one?
No, not really.
So you obviously do have a lot of relationships with a lot of directors, especially Ang Lee. Do you ask for advice?
You know, there are two things that inform my response to that question. You know, one is I actually hate the whole genre of advice, and I find it utterly worthless.
The concept of advice?
The concept of advice. Mm-hmm. I mean, look, here's the craziest thing. And for those of you listening out there, think of the greatest piece of advice you ever got. Do what you love. Yeah, that's a good one. People come up with that all the time. It turns out that the genre of advice is founded on an epistemological principle whereby whatever you give as advice, the exact opposite is also true. But it's uncanny.
And we have to test this theory now.
Okay, test it. Do what you love. That's what I hear all the time. And
so
I always say to the students,
do what you hate?
I said, how are you going to get ahead in life unless you learn to do stuff you hate? And I hate to tell you this, but I love directing. I love producing. 80% of producing is doing stuff you hate. Unless you really love negotiating nudity riders on SAG contracts with agents, you know, in Beverly Hills. If that's really what you love, maybe, but I don't think so. So please don't do what you love. Learn how to do what you hate so you can do what you love. You can be that person who gets up in the morning a little ahead of everybody else, right? I'm telling you, it works with every single piece of advice
out there. I believe
you
because, and I will say, do what you love is one of the most annoying pieces of advice ever. But moving on, you then make your film. You did not ask for advice, if I understand the last answer clearly.
I did. You know what? I found myself listening and trying to be reminded of what some of these great filmmakers I've had the honor and luxury and privilege to work with. But one of the things I learned was don't learn from them. If I tried to work with actors, let's say the way Aang does, because, oh, that's a great way to do it because he's, you know, Aang and obviously that's the best, I would fail miserably because every director does it his or her own way. And you have to establish your own protocol and your own trust. So I thought if I try to imitate anybody, I'll fail before I even begin. And that was a big lesson for me.
So you're just going with instinct?
You know, it's a combination of instinct and a feedback loop with the people around you. You have to remember, I'm directing people like Linda Eamon, who I know, you know, maybe not be a household name, but she's been
Well, I was going to mention that you do have a number of really great Broadway actors in the movie, including her and Tracy Letts.
And Tracy Letts. I mean, he's won a Tony. He's won a Pulitzer. He's 6'4". He's Tracy Letts. I'm not. And I'm giving this guy direction. And Linda has been nominated twice for a Tony. Danny Burstein, who plays Marcus's father. He's actually Tevye on Broadway right now. These are, you know, gods among us. And they're no dummies. And that was great. So I would get the feedback and the pushback. And I've learned to really trust when great actors are having a problem, it's time to listen.
Did you do the Broadway thing partly because these guys are not movie stars?
I did the Broadway thing for a couple of reasons. I shot locally in New York. We were in the New York zone and we didn't have money to travel many people and house them. And number two is always, however, I love New York theater scene. I love these actors so much. And any chance I have to work with one of these folks and hope they could possibly break out into the culture a little further, I take it.
So then your movie is done. You've been to Sundance a few times as an executive, looking for stuff to buy. So this time it's you, your film. You've got to be going into it thinking, I hope people will want to bid on this thing.
Yeah, it's a bit nerve-wracking, but I had an expectation that we would get out with a distributor. We ended up selling the film for a very healthy price, but I will tell you this, not too healthy a price. I'm now sitting here in the enviable position, at least for me, of knowing that my investors are getting all their money back and their VIG. And that is a moral burden on me. I didn't want anybody to lose money on this film. And I landed with a great distributor who didn't pay too much for it. So that the stress going into the marketplace, and this is a tricky marketplace, is there. And we'll have to do well for them to make money on it. And I want them to. But they've been great. I mean, it's been fun to work with another team, of course, having run a studio for so long. I can imagine I was their worst nightmare going into the first meeting after Sundance, you know.
Well, yes, you're used to saying market it this way and don't mm-hmm. do that. And did you get to do that? Or are they like, you know, it's fine, but you don't work here?
I think that what happened was we established a kind of pas de deux, a mutual rhetoric that went something like this. James, I am not worthy. I am not worthy. But if you want to show me what you're doing, that's great. But really, it's your thing. But, you know, I really wanted to make a point that they really are the studio. It's they're in the game. And it's already been over 2 years since I've been in it. And things can change rather drastically in terms of this business. I know because I lived through it for so, and I still am for so long. That said, after all of the pleasantries, colloquy, everything else, they were just amazingly collaborative. And they invited me into the process in a way that has been just a dream.
Well, so state of the industry a little. They tried to kind of make it into a quasi-genre label for a while, and they seem now to have reverted back to just go back to what you were doing before. Is that not right?
You know, you're the person who can tell us.
Well, hypothetically
I'm a mere listener at this point. Uh-huh. But yeah, look, of course, it was an experiment. They did, of course, more or less evacuate the old Focus features.
Yeah, I read somewhere, I think you said that was what really shocked you. It's not that you got fired, but that so many of your staff.
Yeah, exactly. There was a gigantic house cleaning. About 90% of the team was removed. And then they, of course, purchased another company, Film District, and then lifted that up and just put the logo of Focus and moved that whole team. And you know, they gave that business a 2-year run. And are now apparently going back to a model. And it's great, in fact, that at the studio, they're going to make a renewed commitment to making these kinds of films and figuring out how to distribute them.
Not the most obvious thing for a studio right now, certainly. I mean, you could say indie film is dead, except it keeps not being dead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And look, the speech that is regularly rehearsed, even I'm sure on your show and in print and online and in all other media that we've heard since more or less the mid-90s, I guess, which is this is the end of the independent film business. It's the same speech you hear every year. And yet somehow the Oscar goes to Spotlight, the Oscar, and this year's Oscar goes to Birdman. Or, I mean, mm-hmm. I'm sorry. These films seem to be still here. They seem to be kicking. And I love a lot of them. So here's what I think is really going on that allows that complaint to be continued. Because you're absolutely right. There's not a lot of money or as much money as there was before. The golden days when the independent sales business in the international foreign marketplace was driving profits even before the films were made, and that would be in the late 80s through the mid-90s, is gone. That said, you know what? A lot of people have a lot less money these days if you haven't noticed what's going on out there in our country and our world. And, you know, we still get up in the morning, get to make movies, and I'm sorry. You know, would I have loved to have had $2 or $3 million more to make Indignation? Yes. Would I have loved to pay everybody more? Yes. We're just fine. We're hitting our daily calorie count. We're in a business, and we better be freaking grateful that we're in the movie business.
Now, you not only did this, all these other things on the film, but you wrote lyrics for a song in the film.
Yeah.
Is It Love is the name of the song.
Yeah, Is It Love. And with my composer, Jay Wadley, this is really his first feature film scoring for, you know, with an ensemble and orchestra. And he's just, we had more fun than you can ever imagine working together. And yes, we decided to write the radio hit of 1951 and put it together. And I got Jane Monheit, for those jazz fans out there listening. Yes, Jane Monheit came and agreed to sing it. And it was the most fun I had on the whole film was that recording session.
Did you work cheap?
Cheap and fast.
Oh, that's perfect. That's absolutely perfect. James Shamus is the director and writer of the film Indignation. Thank you so much for coming in.
Well, thank you for having me.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can hear The Business on demand with the KCRW smartphone app and get the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.